K-Mud Podcast presents.
Welcome to Mindful Mud. I'm Fluina Nikle. I'm your host. I'm a Zen teacher and mindfulness instructor. And today I'm really fortunate to have Heidi Byrne here with me on Zoom, calling in. Welcome, Heidi. So Heidi, some of you might know, is a local Humboldt person. And Heidi Byrne is a meditation teacher in the Insight meditation tradition and is the founder and guiding teacher of Pacific Mindfulness. She has been teaching since 2005, offering classes, series, courses, nature retreats, and trauma-informed and resiliency-focused professional programs, and teaches regularly for Spirit Rock Meditation Center. She holds certification in mindfulness facilitation from UCLA, trauma resiliency from the Trauma Resource Institute, and is a member of the International Mindfulness Teachers Association. Heidi is especially interested in the integration of the common sense, accessible, and timeless teachings of awareness, ethics, and compassion into the complexity of our everyday lives. She's known for her grounded, down-to-earth humor and presence. She has a background in nursing, 35 years in small business ownership, and lives with her family in Northern California. Again, welcome, Heidi.
Thank you, Fluorina. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor.
Oh, absolutely. So this will be a conversation about mindfulness, obviously, and I'm very curious to hear your take on a lot of topics here. Yeah, so Heidi, I am very curious, just how did you end up being interested in a mindfulness practice?
Great question. Thank you for it. You know, it came about slowly over time. I think that I first became aware of just in general awareness practices in college. I think I took a psychology course or a philosophy course, and I thought, oh, that makes so much sense to me. And it sparked something in me that I thought, oh, I should really think about this. I should really study more in this direction. And then I didn't. And then I finished college and went to nursing school and got married and have babies. And my life took a very different, regular, everyday route. But there was a thing in the back of my mind about, I should go back to that. I should go back to that. There's something that makes so much sense to me about wisdom practices in general and thinking about the nature of being alive and how does pain work? How does suffering work? How does joy work? How does love work? What happens when we actually give our attention to anything? And then through nursing, it wasn't quite the right fit for me for lots of reasons. And I just had that sense of there's something else to do. There's something else to discover. And my children were growing. And when my daughter was in middle school, she and I decided to take an intro to yoga class in Arcata. And it was really, really sweet. And I think it was 3 or 4 weeks, and she was in seventh grade. And not many seventh graders tend to go with their moms to yoga. And she came with a friend, and at the end of the intro class, she said, okay, I'm done. And I kept going. And it changed my life in such a beautiful and profound way. And I discovered that through the practice of yoga and that kind of body awareness, internal awareness, that yoga was really a meditation practice for me. And then my teacher at the time gave me a book by my now mentor of many, many years, Sylvia Boorstein. And my teacher at the time was Robin Smith, who some of you may know. And the book is called Pay Attention for Goodness Sake by Sylvia Boorstein. And I read that book and I thought, this is for me. I need to find her. I need to figure out where she's teaching. And I knew she was teaching at Spirit Rock, but I needed to figure out how to connect with what she was talking about. So I started listening to a lot of talks, and this is around 2000 or so, very early 2000s. I started listening to a lot of Dharma talks. I started reading everything that I could read and started meditating on my own and realized that it was a vast inner landscape that I didn't know much about and that I really wanted to learn about what was happening inside my own mind, heart, body as it related to my everyday life and raising children. And so that's what happened. And then ultimately, within a couple of years, I did get connected with Sylvia by knocking on the door a lot. Please, please, will you talk to me? And she's now a very dear friend, and she has been my primary mentor for all these years. And that's what happened. That's how I got here.
Wow, what a wonderful story, Heidi. Yeah, it's really so beautiful to hear different stories, how folks come to mindfulness, right? And I love what you said. Yeah, you know, you got introduced, and you're like, yeah, this makes a lot of sense. And then you put it on the shelf, right? Life was not ready. Something wasn't ready yet.
Exactly.
And you didn't ever forget. And it comes back. And I hear this from a lot of people, right? A lot of people have kind of like that get introduced a little bit, and it's just not urgent enough, almost, like, right?
That's right.
And then it's like, oh, and then suddenly you remember, and then it's right, and you take it out. Yeah, because it does make a lot of sense, right?
Well, it gives me chills when you say, and then you remember.
Right.
Because that's what this is about, is who am I really in relationship to this life, and how do I live a life that is deeply meaningful with all of the complexity, all of the hardship, and all of the beauty? What about you, Florina? What brought you into this practice?
Oh, wow. What brought me? A big, big, big crisis with 18. I was between life and death with 18. And I was kind of done with life on many levels. I was very deeply anorexic and was between the worlds for quite a while. And then, as you said, a book, right? A book. My first action out of that being just kind of like I'm done with life is picking up the book Simply Zen by Yoko Beck. Hmm. And I read the first page and I was like, oh, okay. I get it. There is a way for me in this world. So that kind of thing. And from then I was jumping very rigorously into Zen and practiced and worked on myself. Yeah, that's kind of
saved your life, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh god, yeah.
That's what happens here.
Yeah, it's between life and death. It is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that that's true for everybody. So we don't give people the wrong impression.
And yeah. Very
and it
good.
can be literally for some between life and death, or it can be metaphorically living a very autopilot life that might feel a little flat, that just doesn't have the juice that one wants, and then something shifts into a way of being utterly present for your life, no matter what it brings, but to be here and experience it.
Yes, I'm really glad you said that, because that can be very much misunderstood. And I mean this in the way of, yes, it's always between, when you say that flatness, that autopilot of what sometimes just feels like, what am I even doing here? Like,
yeah.
What is this all about? And then suddenly, through a simple but not so easy practice, we can start to get a completely different way of feeling life and alive, right? Yeah.
And what a gift that is.
Mm, yeah. So how would you describe mindfulness?
So we can talk about it from a couple of different perspectives. I think that mindfulness is the full awareness of whatever is happening in our hearts, our minds, and our bodies at any given time. And that's hard. Yeah, we check out from the mind, check out from the heart. Some people can't feel the heart. Some people can't feel the body. And in a more secularized definition of mindfulness, you might think of it as mindfulness is paying attention on purpose, non-judgmentally, with curiosity and a willingness to be with what's here. Non-reactive awareness. I'm much less interested in that definition than when my mind and my heart and my body are in the same place at the same time, then mindfulness is alive. That for me, Matt, it makes more sense, because we can pay attention to whatever is happening in front of us. You know, you can describe colors, textures, tastes. We can do this from the perspective of the senses, which is a way to get very raw data. What do I hear? What do I see? What do I smell? What do I taste? But why does that matter? And I think that this is an important piece, because oftentimes in secular mindfulness, in the way it can be diluted, we think mindfulness is paying attention non-judgmentally, just knowing, oh, this is happening, and this is happening, and this is happening. But to ask the question, why does it matter, engages the heart, engages the values, our morality, our kindness, compassion. It's a place where wisdom can really grow, and it almost, an air hole can be created from, I think, deep within us when we know why we're doing what we're doing and why it's important to cultivate awareness connected to the heart, connected to our values, that then the wisdom can bubble up and arise. I think it was Mary Oliver who said, paying attention without the heart is simply a report.
Yeah.
Isn't that great? Because awareness has to be connected to the heart, and then we get what Ram Dass said is loving awareness.
Hmm. It's that, it's for me, yes, it's wonderful how you describe this. It gives substance, right,
totally,
to the awareness. It gives
totally
the feeling. It gives the embodiment. You know,
yes,
for me, and as you said, you came through it through yoga, right? It's just such an embodied practice. And for me as a body worker and Qigong teacher, it's the same thing. It's like this embodiment is so important, especially for us Westerners. And it gets forgotten a lot, especially on certain spiritual paths. And it's the substance that it's the change that really makes a difference when we go into that feeling and substance and body connection and heart connection.
Exactly what you're describing. Then it's embodied.
Mm-hmm.
And we can throw these words around and we don't, it doesn't have much meaning unless you actually pause and say, what does it mean to be embodied?
And perhaps listeners can check in right now with their bodies. Can you feel it? Like, what's your posture? Are you sitting? Are you standing? Are you walking? Are you driving? Like, can you feel your breath? Can you feel your body? That is, right? That is a little piece of mindfulness right there.
And if you can't feel any of those places, that's okay. The awareness of, I don't feel my belly. That's okay. That's just the awareness of, I don't feel my belly. I don't really feel my breath, you might think, but you know you're breathing because you're alive. So breathing is happening. So the beauty about the non-judgmental awareness is that the invitation is to be aware of what is here and also what is not here without judging oneself, no matter what in there. We're just becoming aware of what we know and what we don't know. We don't always know what we don't know, but I'm talking about the awareness of it. So as Florina said, do you feel yourself sitting? Do you feel yourself, your hands? Just notice. And it's okay not to.
You know, it's so wonderful when you say, even if you don't feel it, right? That's information. To everything is information. I hear from there's a lot of interesting ideas floating around what mindfulness actually is, right? So yes, if you don't feel, or if you do feel and you might feel something that you not like so much and you might not call it mindfulness, it's all information. It's all mindfulness. So
it is all information.
Mm-hmm.
You might know this story, Florina, and anybody listening. This is one of my favorite stories about mindfulness of the mind, which is actually what the Buddha taught as the third foundation of mindfulness. There are different areas of doorways in of how we can cultivate awareness. And Thich Nhat Hanh tells a story about being very aware when he has a toothache, and that the pain is intense. And when he has this toothache, he knows that it causes him some suffering, but he forgets to notice when he doesn't have a toothache. And in the non-toothache, there's freedom, there's relief, there's openness. So can you also notice the absence of discomfort? And what happens when you notice that? Because discomfort usually has the loudest voice. It draws our attention for sure. But to notice the space around it, to the space that is okay. So when you are experiencing times of, I'm actually okay right now, take that in. What does it feel like in your body, in your heart, to feel okay? Are your shoulders dropped? Is your belly relaxed? Are you satisfied hunger-wise? All of that. Notice when you're okay and take that in.
Yes, and that's really the big part of resiliency building, right? That building the container. There's always way more to the experience than the narrowed mind that goes into the negative stuff, right? That negativity bias of the brain is real, and we live in it. And especially in the world we do live, that's so demanding, and that's so full of, let's say, negative and awful news. How can we deal with all of this, right? That's a big, big question. How can we even allow ourselves to be happy? Like when we think about the doom of the climate or the planet or whatever, you know, you're really biting your teeth on. Like, is it even okay anymore to be okay and to be happy? So do you want to say a couple of words about?
Yeah, I'd love to say a lot about that. The world needs people who are okay to do the work of helping to cultivate the healing that is necessary of our world. And we could go along and say, it's all going to pot. Why should I do anything? How can I even be happy when there is truly so much suffering? We know there is tremendous suffering in the world. And for anybody who is listening today, I know for me and probably for Florina, we are in a place where we are physically safe, where we're comfortable. We have the great good fortune of really being okay right here. And part of resiliency building is those of us who are okay need to continue to be okay, to support ourselves in this way and not doubt that it's not okay. If somebody else is suffering, they need those of us who have more capacity right now to help. Remember Mr. Rogers, the story of Mr. Rogers when he was upset about something and he said to his mother, there's all this suffering, what do I do? What happens when I feel like I'm in trouble? And she said, look for the helpers. Look for the helpers. Because probably there are always some helpers, and it is right to feel well. It is right to feel well because then we do build capacity. If all of us were wrecked, I have so much to say about this.
Go for it.
Okay. When there is a tremendous amount of suffering, I want to talk a little bit about war. And intense suffering, intense violence, when there are factions fighting one another, and they cannot have empathy for each other because their pain is so extraordinary. There's a beautiful Israeli writer, his name is Yuval Harari, who wrote on this after October 7th, and he said something that I will never, ever forget. He was talking about the lack of empathy on both the Palestinian and Israelis' sides for each other, because the pain is so intense. The suffering is astronomical and unimaginable. And what he said is, we need you. We need all of you outsiders to help us hold this pain. We need your empathy, your capacity, because we can't do it for ourselves right now. But when this is over and we can come out on the other side, what you've been holding for us will help us. And it moved me very deeply, because we are interconnected, because everything is connected to everything else, no matter where you live on the planet, no matter what your cultural identifications are. The pain is so enormous, and the work of resiliency and capacity and love, actually, is to be able to say, yes, this suffering is real, and I'm okay right now, and I can help you hold this pain. That's a long answer to your question.
No, and it's wonderful. I'm really glad you bring that up, because it is, in a way, so important to not turn everything, like to disconnect, right? Or to jump into the other extreme of just getting angry and, you know, and fuel that energy. And as you said, I think this is really where we're going as humans, understanding and feeling, again, embodying that interconnectedness. I mean, When we look at the new neuroscience, let's talk about Daniel Siegel, right? He's even going so far to say we, right? It's the me and the we. And
the intra-connection, yes.
So really, I do believe if we want to survive a species that I'm still very hopeful we will, that is where we need to go, because that's when we do really start living that, as you said, the compassion, the connectedness. Then we start to understand on a very deep level how my actions are contributing to the whole world. My loving is feeding the love. My hate is feeding the hate. And that's where, for me, the practice comes in. It comes as a very big political act, in a way.
It is. It's a radical act to love. It is a radical act to say, the violence is going to stop with me. This practice of awareness is, in some ways, a radical act of incredible presence. And so, to your point, we have to show up, but we show up in different ways. And that place of, it's not going to matter what I do, it's all so difficult, it's all a mess, it matters what we do. It really matters that we're having this conversation, and that maybe there's somebody who is listening to our conversation who says, okay, what I do matters, even in my family, in my little community. Because if we can create these little pockets of care and resiliency, they will grow. I think we can trust that.
Yes. And there is so much of it already happening, and tuning into that and nurturing that, right? And
That's right.
It matters very much how we speak, how we act to the people that are right here with us.
You know, the other thing I wanted to go back to that you brought up is, in the face of so much heartache and so much suffering, and this goes to how do we cultivate capacity and resiliency, being very attuned to what we consume is really important. The amount of news that we consume, and in what formats, how much social media, how much newspaper, how much television, how much radio, where do you get your news from, and what is the tone of that news? Because the media, I think, is designed to keep us on this gerbil wheel of outrage, and that is not good for our nervous system. That keeps this cortisol going, that keeps us in high alert, which degrades our resiliency. So connecting to nature, read a paper book, like get a book out, make a cup of tea, sit down and read a fun novel. It's important.
Yeah, and then we go back right to where we started, is every action is important. Like, again, what you take in, what you put out, right? And all of it is feeding each other. And when we start to practice more mindfulness, we start to notice that, right?
Yeah.
We all know how different we feel if we just have watched perhaps news. I don't even have news, but I listen to news.
Yeah.
Because of the pictures, they overwhelm me. I can't do it. I can't do it to my nervous system. It's just too much. But I do listen to some news. But like what comes in, we all know how it feels to listen to the doom gloom, right? Or people being upset and having big discussions and disagreeing. Or going on a walk.
Yeah.
Somewhere in nature. Yeah. So making conscious decisions is really where it's at. And it's not so easy to do, right? We're all a little lazy sometimes.
It's not so easy to do, and I think we can mistake mindfulness for thinking that we have to be in that paying attention, hyper paying attention mode every moment. That's just not natural. But it's a way of living, and it builds on itself. And going for a walk in nature resets the nervous system, but it also is beautiful. And it's exercise and it's breathing and it's such a wholesome thing to do.
Yeah. So what would you give as an advice or as an encouragement for folks? How can folks invite more mindfulness into their lives in a doable way, let's say?
The first thing that comes to mind is slow down a little bit. I don't know what everybody's lives are like, but we do live in a culture that measures our worth by what we produce. And that's a pressure. That's a really big pressure to produce, to provide, to keep going on to the next thing. How many things are on my to-do list, and to just keep going and going and going. So there's a way in which slowing down, maybe putting fewer things on the to-do list, trying out what happens if you have fewer things on the to-do list instead of the pressure of, I have to get all of this done today. What if you don't? What happens if you don't do that and you spread things out a little bit? So the first thing that comes to my mind is just slow down a little bit. Pause in between tasks. You know this. There's such a beautiful teaching in Zen practice. These are old adages. When you're doing the dishes, do the dishes. When you're sweeping the floor, sweep the floor. Really just do what you're doing in that moment. You know, we think that multitasking works. I can do 5 things all at the same time. And you might get pretty good at that. And it is possible to do some of that. But the brain isn't structured that way. And so none of it is nearly as efficient or satisfying or engaging. And so I think also when you're doing the dishes, what if you pay attention to the texture of the water, to the soap, to the sponge, and actually be present for the experience of doing the dishes? Or if you're sweeping the floor, it's pretty satisfying to make a pile of dirt on the floor and to actually pay attention to what's in this dirt. Where is it all coming from? Like what if you really are part of the experience of sweeping the floor, and then the reward is you have a clean floor. But it is about being present for whatever it is you're doing. You know, if you're with a friend and you have your cell phone, put it out of the line of sight. Don't put it face down on the table between you when you're having tea. That is an automatic distraction because it's there and there's some sort of vibe that comes from the phone. Check me, check me, check me. You know, really being with whatever you're doing as wholeheartedly and as presently as you can.
Thank you, Heidi. Yeah, that's that. That's that. Yes, you know, cleaning is a good one, right? I mean, cleaning is such a good, it's not just a good practice to be like with, but it's also a good metaphor for cleaning the mind, because it's not so easy. Normally we clean and we think about the next thing we need to do, right? Or that conversation we had, and or this moment that you blew it, or whatever negative thing that comes through your mind, right? Instead of being present with cleaning. So, you know, like part of the Zen training is always work, right? Or retreats, right? There's always part is not just sitting, but it's also working, being present with working, and just cleaning a window, for instance, is just like, wow, is to clean your mind and clean a window at the same time by being present, by cleaning the window. And then, as you said before, that nervous system can settle in, right? Yeah. We don't have to constantly go with that autopilot mind, and we don't have to constantly be a slave of it.
And you don't have to clean the window quickly.
Yeah.
You know, like that is such a great metaphor of cleaning a window and cleaning the mind, to be steady, not fast, but steady, and watch what happens in the motion of whatever one is doing.
I have a funny story. during one of the retreats, that was years and years ago, but during one of the retreats, one of the people who was attending the retreat, one of her job was to clean the bathrooms. And she's like, and I cleaned the bathroom and I wasn't aware. So I just cleaned it again to be aware. this is kind of the practice, right? Just like, darn
that's
it.
Really good.
I missed the cleaning the toilet or the bathroom. So I'm going to just do it again.
That was one clean bathroom.
Yeah. But I
think that it's a great example of how we miss our lives. I mean, how many times has any of us gotten in the car to go somewhere and you're halfway there and you forget, where am I going? What am I doing? Or I get to the next town and I totally missed what was in between. Because I'm listening to the music, or I'm somewhere else. I am anywhere but here. And there's just so much to be here for.
Yes, thank you, Heidi. There's so much to be here for. Even just one breath. What a present. Like what a joy it can be.
You know, to jump on that, you know, how when people are afraid that they can't breathe because of illness, and somebody gets a good clean breath, that is a joy. It is uplifting. It is a gift. It's not small. It's a big deal. And we take so much for granted.
We take most things for, pretty much everything.
That's true. That's right.
Yeah. Any movement really that we're doing is, we can be grateful for, because if we do break an arm, we're not going to be lifting it. So just lifting an arm can be such a joy. Yeah.
Such a joy. My arm lifts and it doesn't hurt. All right. That piece back to what do you notice and what do you not notice? Because we don't tend to notice when we feel well. It takes feeling unwell. And then there's lots of opinions about that. Like, oh, I did something wrong. Or the languaging around illness, there's something wrong. It would be nice to change the cultural conditioning around that. I mean, maybe there's something off. The body is giving a signal it needs some attention. But it isn't wrong to experience illness. It's normal.
I do think what you're describing is so important in the way of everything, in the way of when we start slowing down and we start paying more attention to the internal world, as you said, when you started with this practice, that vast internal experience that you had so little idea of.
Yeah.
When we go in there, things shift, the perception shifts, and that right and wrong is not so black and white anymore, right? And there, it's actually almost dissolving. Because it's just a presence, period. And when we can live from that presence, then we're free. Then everything is possible. We spend so much time, it really reminds me, so much time of judging, right, wrong, And then especially ourselves. Whoa, we're so hard on ourselves, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. What are some practices you would say are helpful with that, you know, judging mind, especially that self inner critic?
Yeah, let's talk about the inner critic. I think that the place to start, let's talk about a couple of, in order to get there, let's talk about a couple of foundations of mindfulness as a way to build into that place of where did this judging mind even come from? So the Buddha taught that there are primary foundations of mindfulness. The first area is mindfulness of the body, which includes mindfulness of the breath. So to be aware of this body entirely means, can we be aware of the skin, the sense of touch, this physical body? Like if we really look at the way we know anything is happening is through the sense of taste, touch, smell, sight, sound, and consciousness, thinking about it. And all that's ever going on really are these different permutations of what's happening that's coming into the body that we perceive through the senses. But we also have this whole vast thing going on internally, all of the different systems in the body that are completely connected with each other. But if you think about what's on the inside of the body, the bones, the tendons, the tissues, the fluids, it's pretty amazing. So cultivating awareness of this body internally, which can be hard, but there's this whole internal experience happening, especially if you get a gut ache, as an example, when the body gives a signal internally of whatever's going on, or hunger or thirst, then there's all of the awareness externally of the body, maybe this feeling of touching a desk, sitting, whatever it is, all the different external ways. And then from that very basic awareness of the body, then we might experience, oh, this is pleasant. Oh, this is unpleasant. Oh, this is somewhere in the middle. I'm not really sure. And this is what's called the second foundation of mindfulness, the awareness of pleasant, unpleasant, or maybe a neutral area that we don't really pay attention to. And where this is important as it relates to the judgmental mind and the inner critic is that when we experience something, typically through the body, it is going to be somewhere on that continuum line between pleasant and unpleasant. Anything we come in contact with is going to be like that. And it's an interesting thing to experience for anybody who's listening. Just take a look around where you are right now, and you might notice the full range of what you see that's pleasant, what you see that's sort of pleasant, what you see that has no real feeling for you, maybe a little neutral. And then you might see something that you think is really unpleasant. So it's all right there. And now if you look at the thing that's unpleasant, what are your opinions about that thing that's unpleasant? And where are those opinions coming from? And is there a voice inside of you that says, that shouldn't be there, or I don't like that, and I just don't want that to be there? And the reason I don't like that is because the person who gave it to me hurt my feelings one day. And when that happened, I argued with them. And so do you see where I'm going with? Like, we string a whole story together based on pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And in that unpleasant side of the spectrum comes our judgment and reactivity. And in the judgment and reactivity, oftentimes it's turned on ourselves, the inner critic, that says, I shouldn't feel like this. I shouldn't be like this. I should have known. I didn't know. All the languaging around the inner critic that tells us we're not okay for one reason or another. And typically it comes from our conditioning, whatever happened in our early years, our families, our communities, our education. It could be intergenerational trauma. There's so many factors that go into why we see the world the way we see the world. There's that very famous quote from Anais Nin when she said, "We don't see the world as it is, we see it as we are." We don't see the world as it is, we see it as we are. And we can't help that. That's the conditioning. Those are the lenses that we see the world through that form the inner critic. And so to understand that the unhelpful voices inside, maybe unkind, the critical voices, come from lots of places, lots of conditioning, but they can be stimulated by the contact with something that we don't like, something that we feel is unpleasant. And it's often said in this whole practice of mindfulness and in the Dharma that it is a practice of learning to be with the unpleasant, befriending ourselves as we are, to understand the causes for these views, the conditions that bring them about. So this is the reason I bring it into, we take the first foundation of mindfulness so we can start understanding that the body, this breath, gives us all this information. It's how we perceive the world. And then whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, that conditions our thoughts, our words, our actions. And then this, another area of mindfulness, mindfulness of the mind, our thoughts and our emotions. So it's quite interconnected. These systems all work together. And what to do about the inner critic, I think the very first thing is to recognize that it's there and that it's typically a habit, that it might not be based on the truth. It might be real that, oh, there's that voice in my mind that is saying something unkind to me, but is it true? Is it actually true? And that's where the practice comes in, to say, oh, I have all these opinions that come from a lifetime of conditioning, of certain kinds of education, of ways of seeing the world. But through mindful awareness, another way that I really love to define mindfulness is choice. To pause and to make a choice. What am I seeing? What am I experiencing? How do I want to be with this? How do we want to transform reactivity into responsiveness? And responsiveness comes from kindness and wisdom and from the heart. Reactivity often comes from fear, startle, anger, outrage. So I think we start with befriending ourselves, learning to befriend ourselves, which is a huge task. So the inner critic has something to say. And with practice, I think what grows is the ability to not believe it. To say, oh, there's that habitual voice again. You can just go sit down over there. I heard one person talk about the inner critic as my itty bitty shitty committee that lives in my mind.
Yes.
So that's a long answer. But yeah. What would you say to that?
It comes from the practice that we don't believe that story anymore so much. Right. A lot, as you, it's so true what you're saying. Most of what's happening when we do live in autopilot, and we all do sometimes,
for sure,
is that we just live a story.
Yeah.
It's a story that who knows how it got built through our childhood, perhaps even before. I mean, again, and we don't really have to obsess too much how it got created. I think the more we can touch back into the very present moment as it is now.
Yeah.
How is it really now?
How is it really now?
Then that story is simply a story.
You know, but it's doesn't not the mean truth that it anymore. Doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that it doesn't matter.
It matters. Yes.
It matters because it informs so much about us.
It matters very much to look at those habits and the story, and it does not mean that we have to believe it all.
You know, I appreciate what you said about maybe it doesn't matter where it all comes from. I mean, yes, it's helpful to know, oh, I have these habits, these views, these parts of my traits or characteristics that come from these places. And very often, I think in Western psychology, a lot of the work is to understand our childhoods, to understand our past, that helps us make sense of who we are. But there comes a time, I think, that rehashing why I am the way I am can actually cause more suffering. And that a very helpful question, in addition to understanding who we are, is, and the suffering that has brought us to this moment, is where is the suffering leading?
How do you mean that?
Where is the suffering leading? Okay, so I understand my family history. I understand the positives. I understand the challenges. I understand why I might have this worldview. But is it helpful to me? Or it's just helping me understand my past. But what I really want to know is, how has everything that I've experienced in my life, both beautiful and despairing, where is it leading? Where is this taking me? And so where it brought me, and I think for many of us, as you described, deep suffering brings us into spiritual practice very frequently. And when I came to this practice, my children were teenagers, and there was a lot of bickering. There was a lot of conflict in the house. And I can remember saying, I'm just going to go in my room and shut the door. I needed a place to literally escape from what they were doing. It was too much stress for me. And so the suffering of that was also part of what led me into this practice. So that's what I mean about where is this suffering leading? Or as Thich Nhat Hanh says, you know, we have no mud, no lotus, right? And what he says is make good use of the mud. So I think that's the same thing. How do we make good use of all the material we have to work with to turn it into something beautiful?
All of it is fertilizer, right?
It's all fertilizer.
Everything that we've experienced, as hard as it was, it's all fertilizer. The question is, what are we growing on it?
So that's the same thing as right. Where is this
suffering
leading?
Where is he going? Yeah.
Yep.
And it's, again, when you say another way to describe mindfulness, it's choice. I like that a lot because when we do stop, when we can start slowing down and sinking more into truth of this moment, wow, there is choice. There is choice for all kinds of things. And then it becomes really joyful too.
Yeah. Yeah. I can choose not to do that anymore. And I can choose to do this. Huh. What permission to give ourselves to live in a different way.
Right. And I can acknowledge the difficulty. Right. I can acknowledge the difficulty that I feel, but I don't have to fuel it. And I don't have to sink 100%. Into despair about it. Yes, but it's so we talked a lot about suffering, right? So, and mindfulness is not just a way to deal with suffering. It's also a way to just be in joy, right? Like, I would actually
love
to, yeah, I would, because I know that you go out into nature a lot, right, Heidi? And you do actually nature retreats. I'm just really curious to hear more about that.
Okay, good. Well, I think that I find so much joy being outside. To be in nature in almost any capacity for me is heart lifting. It's grounding. It's certainly settles my nervous system, but I just like being outside. And it's not more complicated than that. And I think I learned early on, backpacking as a teenager, experiencing that intense awe being in nature, and that it touched something in me that I didn't touch any other way, to be on a long hike in some spectacular place, or to be on a walk in not a spectacular place. It doesn't have to be heart-stopping, magnificent beauty to have the benefit of being outside. So I've known that for a long time, that it's a very grounding, nurturing place for me to be. And then as I got involved in teaching, because being out in nature has always been important to me, it seemed like a very natural extension of bringing mindfulness into how else can we experience presence. And in a formal meditation practice, sitting in a maybe silent room on a cushion, there's so much more to it than that. It's a beautiful thing to have that kind of sacred, quiet, protected space for meditation. But to go out into nature and to experience the wind or the rain or the temperatures or the sky or whatever is outside, and to learn to be present with that, is another way of becoming present that really speaks to me. And I think that it also, it has a component of, we need to fall in love with this earth in order to really help care for this earth. And the only way to fall in love with this earth is to connect regularly, to understand how much a part of her we are, that we don't live on this earth, we are of this earth, and that the earth is an alive, breathing being. And we are part of the earth's health system. That's the Gaia theory. So if I could, I mean, even bringing my own practice, just going out in my own yard, and just being in my own yard, even doing sitting practice or walking meditation or gardening or just being outside, I feel this deep connection to being alive on this alive planet. So I decided, because I had gone to camp a lot as a kid, and then I was a camp counselor, that we could make meditation retreats in beautiful places that would just be a different kind of camp.
It was just wonderful. Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Just a different way of making camp. So when I first started making nature retreats, it was partially a silent retreat, but in the afternoons we had painting and beading and poetry writing. We did all kinds of things. So there was multiple ways to experience being present with whatever your activity was. So that's where it started from. And then I love being on rivers, and I had been going on river trips and realized that this would be a really good way to create a meditation retreat in concert with an already designed, supported river trip. And so I do that now too. I have some friends who work for river guides for the company Oars. And so I asked, well, what would you think? Could I make one of these trips into a meditation retreat? And so that was in 2016 or 17. And they said, sure, let's try. So we've been doing that. And it's a regular river trip where the guides are there and they do what river guides do, including make all the delicious food. And I just weave a meditation retreat into an existing river trip. And it's wonderful. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, I bet. That sounds really divine. And I just love when you said, you know, bringing our presence into nature. It's not just that we are connecting with ourselves and we are regulating ourselves, but we're actually helping to regulate the earth.
We are.
It's that give and take. It's that, again, let's go into interconnectedness, not just between humans.
Right.
Everything is alive.
Everything is alive.
Can we start notice that aliveness and be that aliveness? That's really where I see so much hope and so much joy when we start cultivating cultivating that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And it's a rare opportunity to take 4, 5, 6 days and just be out in the wilderness in a supported way to start understanding that relationship. And it's very hard to have the direct experience of how connected and interconnected we are without having extended time. The extended time is very important. What is it like to sleep outside in a tent or not in a tent? What is it like to take care of your whole life for a week or so outside, even though we bring a lot of gear, of course, but we're definitely subject to the weather. You know, there's always a question on these river trips. What's the weather going to be like? And one of my friends who's a guide says, there's 100% chance of weather.
Yes. You know, it makes me, when you talk about the river trip and being out in nature, it also reminds me of just regular retreats, how important it is to have that chunk of time, right?
Yeah.
To actually really connect. Can you perhaps say a little more about that?
Sure. Yes. I love to sit on a retreat myself as a student. And I do want to say that first and foremost, I am a student. And I do offer these teachings. I do what I do, but I'm a student and I'm exploring all of this right along with everybody else, no matter what my role is. Retreat practice is a very precious time where one gives themselves time away from the regular routine of one's life and usually goes to a center where you get a room, you get your food, there's a lot of teaching, there's a schedule, a structure of a schedule where one might get up early in the morning and balanced with different kinds of meditation, whether it's seated meditation, walking meditation, working meditation. Everything is a meditation, meaning bringing one's awareness steadily and persistently and gently over and over again to whatever is happening. And to be able to do that in a protected environment of a retreat is extraordinary, really, to be able to go away. And many of these retreats are fully silent. Some have some non-silent times. But to have your whole life supported by teachers and cooks and staff who are there just to support your ability to practice, to steady your own mind and heart for an extended number of days, is an extraordinary gift. And it is hard work as the practitioner. Sometimes it can be very hard work to stay that present and not say, okay, I'm out of here. I got to go watch TV. I got to go do something else. Because to be with yourself, to commit to be with yourself in that way over an extended period of time can be intense and can be very beautiful. Also very heartening. One typically learns a lot about oneself through being quiet and being with the mind and heart for a number of days. And then to have teachers who teach, who offer Dharma talks, who offer support, it's very fertile ground, as you said. It's very, very fertile ground. And I love participating in retreats, whether I'm a student or whether I'm teaching. I find that the extended time is one of the most nurturing things that I can do. And where do we go where we get that kind of support for quiet? We put our phones away, not really reading, maybe writing a little bit. Maybe there's some poetry. Maybe there's some journaling. Some people might bring some art supplies as another means of connecting with what they're doing. And there are different kinds of meditation retreats. Some are very, very orthodox, 100% silent, and you don't read, you don't write, you just get your food. And then some, there's a lot of creative ways to experience oneself in that realm. But it is a precious opportunity to go away for a few days and be fully supported in practice.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
I'm kind of curious to hear from you a little bit the challenges of mindfulness, right? We talk a lot about the benefits and...
Great question.
Yeah. What are some, like, when would you say, oh, going within might not be the best idea? Or what are some challenges and how to navigate them?
Yeah. That's a very important question, Florina. And when is going inside not a good idea? There are times where there's a lot of upheaval in somebody's life, maybe high levels of stress, maybe a lot of trauma, maybe a time where there's just too much internal pain to be able to sit quietly and just be with what is happening, the breath coming and going, the mind going here and there. And so it's important if one has that feeling of, I can't do this right now, that you believe it, that you don't do it, or you work with a teacher who can help you say, let's talk about what's literally happening for you. And you don't try to do this alone. That is a very important piece of this practice, is to have community, to have people that you can talk with. And so there, depending on where you are, there are different ways to connect, whether it's in person or online, and there are different resources. But if for you, it feels like I can't meditate, and it feels, I hate to use the word, but so uncomfortable that maybe it's dangerous to you, that you feel like, oh, I'm not touching into being quiet in my mind, that isn't going to work for me, I think that you don't. I think that you trust your intuition and you don't do it unless you have a person to help you with it. So that would be the first thing.
Yeah, very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing to say is that sitting meditation is not the only way. It is only one way to cultivate mindfulness, to cultivate awareness. It's a training. You know, it's a foundational practice of sitting still and learning to pay attention to whatever is happening, be it the breath, sounds, thoughts, whatever it is, and stay steady with that. But there are commonly four traditional, perfectly equal meditation postures of sitting, standing, walking, reclining, and movement meditation is beautiful, and that comes out of the walking. It might be Qigong, it might be Tai Chi, it might be yoga, it might be swimming. It's some sort of way that you're moving with your mind being present, that you're very present for the move, very present with the body, and that may feel more accessible to some people. Sitting still quietly with the breath internally doesn't work for everybody, and it's not meant to. I don't think it's meant to. It's just one way. So I think my feeling about it, Florina, is not encouraging, because there's not one way, there's no forcing here. No forcing. It might be that sitting meditation just doesn't work. It's not attractive. It's not interesting to some folks. But Qigong is. Qigong, I can move, I can feel my body, I can be present, my eyes are open. We're not necessarily silent, maybe we are, and then it's more of an access point. So I think that's really what it is find the access point.
Yes, start where you're at, right?
Yep.
Very important. Thanks for bringing that up. And yeah, no forcing, right?
No forcing.
Sometimes it's such an urgency. And what I also know from a lot of folks is people just don't know where to start.
Yeah,
and this is when it's helpful to have a community, as you said, to have a teacher who can perhaps guide you a certain way and like, try this. There are many different tactics and practices and ways to get started. to invite more mindfulness into your life, because it's always there. The question is how to access it. And that looks different for everybody.
Right. And I think that, you know, when we as teachers, you're a teacher, I'm a teacher, when we say, all right, you might try this, I think that when we offer classes, we're saying, and I'm going to accompany you. I'm going to do this with you. So we're not giving people instruction and saying, okay, go figure it out. We're saying, no, 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 we're doing this together. Here's a way that we are going to be in this together. And the idea of that we accompany each other, I think is very important, that we are both students. We occupy these different roles, but I keep learning more about this all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And I still say to my teachers, you know, I have questions all the time. I still need teachers. Forever I'm going to need teachers. And what a wonderful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the whole idea that we're never done with it.
We're never done with it. And, you know, the other thing that we should bring in here is that I think practices go in cycles. Mm-hmm. That sometimes, you know, somebody might experience quite a lot of juice, let's say, a lot of capacity for meditation to bring mindfulness practices into their life. And then something happens and it stops. And okay, it stops. I mean, it could be, let's say, you know, somebody breaks a leg and it changes their whole life for a few months as they go through the problem of a broken leg and the leg healing. It's going to disrupt one's life. And so when these natural disruptions happen, that can be one of the hardest times to keep spiritual practice going. But it doesn't mean one isn't mindful. It just is a little different flavor of it. So if you can't come to a group or come to a class because there's something happening in your life, that's okay. You can still stay connected. And teachers are there for support for that too.
Good point. Absolutely. Yeah. And I noticed for myself in my own life, my practices have gone through different phases, right? And
Of course.
Yeah. It's different kinds of intensities and practices. And yeah, and that's how everything stays alive too.
I think so. Yeah. And it also allows for our humanity that we're not trying to be perfect at this. This is a way of life. I mean, I can remember a phase I went through where I don't know what was going on. It was some difficulty. And sitting on my meditation cushion and doing what I had been doing didn't feel accessible. And I said to a teacher, I can't even do that right now. And he said, then don't. And I loved that instruction. It didn't mean that I wasn't reading or paying attention or still. I was very aware of what was happening internally and externally. But I just wasn't sitting on the cushion. And it was such a pleasure and such a relief to have a teacher who I really respect say, then don't. It's okay. It's a different phase.
Yes.
And in fact, you know, Jack Kornfield even tells this great story about it. He was in an airport and somebody came up to him and said, Jack, do you remember me? And, you know, he's a pretty famous guy. And he said, I was on retreat with you 25 years ago. and he went on to say, you know, after that retreat, I stopped practicing and it went away. And I never thought about it until I had a heart attack. And then I had a heart attack and I was in the hospital. And the only thing I could do was stay with my breath, one breath at a time. And I realized, oh, I still know how to do this. And Jack said to him, once you start, you can trust it. It's inside of you. You start cultivating this awareness, this way of being with your whole self, which is so beautiful and welcoming and loving and compassionate. He said, don't worry, you're not going to lose it. I found that so reassuring.
It's what I hear a lot. A lot of people have dived into it. They got a taste. And as you said yourself, right, in your own story, like you got interested in college and then, wow, this makes sense. And then it just wasn't part of it.
Yeah. just wasn't happening.
Yeah, and now I even have like little kids that I teach at the school. Where so, you know, like 3 years later, it's like, oh, now I'm using it, you know. My dad
and so
just passed,
to,
yeah.
To your point of interconnectedness and how much what we do matters, you never know what you say or what you do, how that seed that you're planting is going to grow, when that is going to come back. So back to also the point of the world is in such trouble, how can I be happy? We need people who feel okay, because that is what is supporting us. And you never know where your wholesome, skillful actions are going to show up. So a kid says to you 3 years later, oh, now I'm getting it. Instead of you as a teacher saying, ah, they don't get it, I'm not going to do it. No, no. Oh, they don't get it now. I'm going to keep doing it.
Yes. And like having that courage as a practitioner, and I want to encourage everybody out there, because it takes courage to go within and stop and not be distracted 24/7. Yeah. To see how that feels like, right? Often we might think, oh, this is weird. I can't do this. But it's, and it is weird.
Thank you for saying that. It kind of is.
It's kind of weird, you know? But it feels so darn, in a way, so good sometimes, not always, but it feels right. If I say this, yeah, you know, it feels, yes, that's it. It's the right thing to do. It feels
an
it
internal
feels
alignment, yes. Right?
It is. Yeah. So Heidi, I'm really curious. Time flies. Can you tell more about, so you talked about your nature courses year, like your camps, right? Your river trips. That's really fabulous. So what other courses and offerings do you have?
Oh, thank you for asking. Let's start at the top of the week. Every Monday morning at 6:15 a.m., I offer an online drop-in Monday morning sunrise meditation. And everything that I offer can be found on my website, which is pacificmindfulness.com. So you don't need to write all of this stuff down. I'll just tell you the different things. But Monday mornings, it's sweet. We 6:15 Pacific time, and we just come on and we meditate together. And then we have a little time for talking together, people that have questions. So that's every single Monday morning. And I typically have a Monday afternoon or Friday morning series of some kind going. This right now we're looking at the work that reconnects, the work of Joanna Macy and Thich Nhat Hanh also. There's a series. Friday mornings are a time where I almost always offer something at 8:30 in the morning for 2 hours. And those are series courses. Right now it's a poetry series. I regularly offer poetry, meditation, and conversation courses. And that's a lot of fun, where we bring in different poets, sometimes to the classes, but we bring in their poetry and reread it. And we talk about it through the lens of the Dharma and mindfulness. And there's sometimes some Dharma gatherings, and a couple of times a month in Arcata, we meet for Sunday Sangha. We met this morning, and that's drop in. And it's also a hybrid, so you can come online or come to town. And there's just so many other drop-in sorts of things, or, you know, might be a day long or whatever is happening. But everything that I am doing is online. I do offer one-on-one. So if people are interested in having a conversation about how mindfulness might support their lives, we can do that individually. And on my website, I have a section called Talks and Meditations, and there are hundreds of talks that I've given and a whole bunch of guided meditations. So anybody can go on, that's freely offered, and you can just go onto the website and listen to whatever you want to listen to anytime.
What a fantastic offering, Heidi. Thank you. Thank you. So pacificmindfulness.com.
Correct.
Sweet.
Yep. Just like it sounds.
Just like it sounds. Yeah, that's wonderful. And you're located in Arcata, so most of your things are online, and then Sangha Sunday mornings is hybrid.
Yep. And the retreats are obviously in person, although I do have a hybrid retreat coming up for anybody who might be interested in some writing. It's a poetry meditation poetry, dharma, meditation, and writing retreat that is April 7th to 11th at a beautiful center near Boonville called Whisper Tree Retreat that is really worth looking at. It's a gorgeous center. It used to be called Bell Valley, and it's only about 15 miles west of Ukiah. It's very accessible, all good roads, and it's a very beautiful place. And that is a retreat that I'm teaching with a beloved poet. His name is James Cruz. James is out of Vermont, widely published, and a deep Dharma practitioner. And he's going to come, and we're going to do a meditation and poetry retreat together. Wow. And that will be hybrid also.
Wow. Whole retreat hybrid. Sweet.
Yeah, we're working on that. Yep.
Yeah, since COVID, everything shifted, right?
It's really shifted. And it's actually a benefit I never would have imagined.
Yeah, same here. Yeah. It's sometimes these difficult things can create new things as well that are also positive.
So that's another part of this practice. Let's just touch on that before we end, which is in that view, that capacity to transform reactivity into responsiveness, to not believe the story of the inner critic, but to be able to ask the question that says, what else is true? What else is true here? Because we may feel very caught in a difficult place, stuck in the mind with one way of viewing things. But then if there can be a little capacity building, expanding the perspective, as you said earlier, to ask the question, what else is true? That opens up the possibility of choice. That's another way, I think, of experiencing mindful awareness, is there's more than one thing that's true. There's not one truth. And holding many realities expands capacity. Being able to say there are many ways of being. So what else is possible here?
I love what else is possible here, because the truth for me, it's only accessible right now. Everything that's not right now, I have a big question mark. Is that really true?
Yeah, that's right.
So what else is true right now? What's alive, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
What's alive?
I think in general, and we said that a little earlier too, like, the questions are actually really important to have questions.
Yeah.
What are some questions you think are helpful on this path?
Oh, okay. What are some questions? Okay. What am I learning? I mean, we can start with, why am I here? Why does anybody come to a practice? What brought you? Here's the first question. Why are you here? What is bringing you to practice? That might be very easy. Oh, my friend told me I should come.
Why are you listening to the radio right now? Why have you not turned it off yet?
Right. Or have you? And did you come back? So why are you here? What do you hope to learn? So that's another question. And you don't have to have an answer. None of these questions need answers. It is living with the questions themselves that are the ground out of which so much grows. What do I hope to learn? When I first came, what did I hope to learn? I just wanted a place that was a little quiet in my house. I just wanted to go find somewhere else to be. And then it might be, what brings you back? Why are you coming back? Because that's connected to, why am I here? And then what am I learning? What am I learning here? How do you know? How do you know what you're learning? Is it working? Is it working? So when people say to me, you know, after all these years, what have you learned? And I think the overarching answer to that, this will sound very simplistic, is impulse control. That I don't have to respond, I don't have to react. I can feel whatever I feel, and I can know the difference between, this thing happened, the autopilot, the inclination to react, to respond really quickly, but can I pause? Can I wait? Can I say, what is alive? What is here? Because really what I want to do is live a life that is as kind as can be. That doesn't mean sweet, Hallmark nice. It means, can I live kindly, wisely, and reduce the amount of harm I cause towards myself or others? Can I really live like that? And sometimes yes, sometimes no. So I have to come back to, I keep coming back to this practice that really supports me, that gives me permission to inquire, to make these inquiries, to live these questions, and to not know.
Yeah.
To really not know.
You mentioned some very important things, I think, in general for mindfulness. This, we don't need an answer for the questions. The questions itself are a guidance.
Yeah.
And that not knowing is actually really the truth. It's the truth.
It really is. It really is. Can we show up and not know? And we live in this culture that values mastery. You should know. Why? Why should I know? I shouldn't already know. Knowing does not mean better. I mean, we know about beginner's mind. Show up and just be here.
Easy said, right? And that's exactly what the whole culture is avoiding. Exactly,
yes.
Just that. Yeah. Join us and just be here. What? No, that's too painful. But we don't know if it's really painful because we'll never go there.
Yeah.
Because we don't dare to stop. We don't dare to breathe.
Right. Yep.
So this is an encouragement to if you feel inspired or if you look, so many folks are like, oh, mindfulness, yeah, that sounds really good, but I don't think I can do it. And the
but
truth
you don't
is
know what, unless you try.
Yes. And I think I've never met anybody who is curious and wants to try who doesn't find a practice that works for them, right? What's your experience?
Yeah, I think that's right. If what one is seeking is this a practice that is nurturing, that is wholesome, that is about really self-acceptance, really learning about who one is, no matter what is going on, which also is about learning about others, there are so many doorways in, and it does not, I mean, mindfulness practice, let's just call it awareness practice. It comes in so many forms. It doesn't have to be seated meditation. It doesn't have to be Qigong. It could be cooking. It can be gardening. But it requires presence. It requires showing up. You got to show up.
Got to show up. Yeah. I had actually my last show was on cooking.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Actually, the November one was on cooking. And I had a gardening one before as well. With guest teachers.
Because there, you know, there's creativity, there's repetitiveness. You got to be present. You got to pay attention to what you're doing. And because you're putting yourself into this.
Yes, full on.
Full on.
And this is why it's so important to have a lot of self-compassion. And that's something, if you think right now, whoa, that's a high goal. It's something that can be learned. And it's definitely one of those things that have been the biggest learning for me, learning how to accept myself as I am, for sure. Yeah, and it's part of the path. Any last words, Heidi, and perhaps repeat your website again so people can find your wonderful offerings?
So, yes, I can be found at pacificmindfulness.com anytime. And then what I would like to leave us with is the reassurance that we can show up, that our hearts are strong enough for that. And we can do it in just a breath, in just a breath. We can pause, take a breath, tune in, care for ourselves. I am here right now. May I accept myself just as I am right now, and then go do the next thing. And the other part of practice that we didn't talk about so much is the compassion practice. How do we actually have a practice that expands our wish for our own well-being and the well-being of others? And so to very simply give you four phrases that you can take with you and repeat anytime you want. Take one, take two. May I feel safe and protected. May I feel peaceful and happy. May I feel healthy and strong. May I live with ease. And you can say that to each other. May you feel safe. May you feel peaceful. May you be healthy. May you be at ease. Just offering those wishes to yourself or others can really soften your heart and bring you into this present moment.
Thank you again so much, Heidi.
Oh, thank you.
Wow. Yes.
Thank you. And what a pleasure.
Yeah. And you have been listening to Mindful Mud here on KMUD.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.